these whistleblowers, that in fact they have a whole science of addiction that they've developed to deliberately and purposefully create food addiction in their users of their products. For example, they hire craving experts to work in taste institutes to create the bliss point of food, to create heavy users to get more stomach share. Those are the exact terminology that they use in their own documentation and their own companies. And when you look at Big Tobacco and Big Food, they're behaving in many of the same ways. I'm in a movie coming out on May 9th called Fed Up, about childhood obesity, which has been produced by Lori David, who made Inconvenient Truth, and Katie Couric. And the theme of the movie is about childhood obesity, about the power of sugar as a factor that's driving biological addiction and obesity, and calling out the food industry in a very powerful way, documenting how they have demonstrated that their behavior and their approach is very similar to Big Tobacco. And they show even testifying in front of Congress, and one of the Coke Beverage Association experts said, you know, it's recommended the average person consume 2 liters of fluids a day, and we think that Coca-Cola can be an important part of that fluid intake. And I think those kinds of comments are stunning. And when he says there's no evidence that soda plays any role in obesity or chronic disease, it's simply a lie. It's a bold-faced lie. And, you know, Senator Harkin said in the movie, he says, I don't know how they can go to bed at night and sleep, and given what they're doing. And I think that's actually... the more we learn about what's happening, the more we understand that this is actually the kinds of things that are going on and how they're influencing not just, you know, food marketing to children, and they're influencing schools through providing their fast food products in schools. I mean, why should we be selling fast food brands like McDonald's and Chick-fil-A and Burger King in Pizza Hut and Domino's in schools? There's no reason those brands and companies should be in schools, where we should have kindergartens full of chairs that say Coca-Cola on them. That's really driving this behavior that is leading to our chronic disease epidemic.
We're talking today to Dr. Mark Hyman about his latest book, The 10-Day Detox Diet. So, Dr. Harmon, you have a list of very fascinating food myths that you debunk, and one of them is one food myth is that we can conquer our cravings with willpower. And you mentioned that now we know that it's actually a physiological addiction that's going on. So tell us about some of the specifics of the detox that are about conquering the need to use your willpower when you're doing the detox diet.
I think that's a great question. I'm going to break it down into 2 points. The whole issue of willpower, one, and two, how do we actually not have to use willpower but use science to stop food addiction. And the willpower issue is important because it's the underlying theme of the government and of food corporations and of policymakers and many professional agencies and organizations, including physicians and nutrition organizations, have a very simple message, which is the weight problem we have in this country, the obesity, diabetes problems, is all due to a lack of willpower. And they implicitly imply that by saying it's about energy balance. It's calories in, calories out. If you exercise more and eat less, you'll lose weight. It's that simple. There are no good and bad food. It's all about moderation. And the implicit message in that is that you're a fat, lazy glutton, and if you just got off your butt and didn't eat so much, everything would be fine. The problem with that message is, one, it blames the victim, and two, it's scientifically not valid. So when you look at how it actually works, if you understand all calories are not created equal, and that there are good and bad foods, and that sugar and flour calories drive changes in your hormones and your brain chemistry that literally hijack your taste buds, hijack your hormones, hijack your brain chemistry and metabolism, and create behaviors that lead to the obesity epidemic and diabetes epidemic. So to change that, you can change your diet, and this is what the 10-day detox diet does. It literally gives you a roadmap, a program, a sort of a step-by-step philosophy of how to eat in a way that controls insulin and blood sugar and reduces inflammation in the body. And when you do those two things, by cutting out flour and sugar, cutting out processed food, cutting out the main triggers of allergens and inflammation, gluten and dairy, and you add in whole fresh plant foods, nuts and seeds, good quality lean, sustainably raised animal protein and fruit, you see a dramatic change in your physiology very quickly. You have protein for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You have the right kinds of fats. You know, it's not fat, actually, that makes you fat. It's sugar that makes you fat. We're learning that sugar is the new fat. And I think that that's a lesson that most of us have a hard time learning because of the brainwashing by our government and the media over the last 30 years that fat makes you fat, that low fat is good, and that we created a whole industry around this. So you have to actually change your diet in a way that creates a high volume of food, high fiber, low sugar, high phytonutrients, a low glycemic diet, and one that includes a lot of good fats like avocados, nuts, and seeds, and coconut butter and olive oil and so forth. So these are things that can help you really drive the addiction away, alleviate the need for willpower. Why, when you have to white knuckle it, no one's going to win this battle. If you can starve yourself for a few days, fine, but after that, it's almost impossible. I mean, you can't. I mean, yesterday I was busy running around and I didn't have a chance to eat. And by the end of the day, I was really hungry, and I would eat anything. There was almost nothing to eat, so I ate stuff that I normally wouldn't eat because it's hard to control. And even for someone who's written books on this, it's very hard to control.
Well, you mentioned in your breakdown of the 10-day detox that there are certain foods that are better than others at doing certain things, some for controlling inflammation, some that actually boost the efficiency of detoxification pathways, some that are good for gut function. So tell us some of the better foods for inflammation and detoxification.
Well, first you get rid of the foods that are inflammatory and toxic, right? So sugar is the number one toxin in our diet, and anything that turns to sugar, flour, by the way, raises your blood sugar more than sugar. So it's not better. If you have a piece of bread, it's worse than having a tablespoon of table sugar. The sugar causes liver damage in the doses we're consuming it. And the biggest cause of liver failure in this country is sugar. It causes what we call fatty liver or non-alcoholic steatohepatitis or NASH, and it's a serious problem that affects 70 to 90 million Americans, including many children who are drinking sodas and eating liver transplants at 12 years old. So we have to get rid of the toxin that's sugar. Second, we have to get rid of all the chemicals and additives in the food that are driving addiction, like MSG, for example, which spikes insulin and drives cravings and makes you hungry, and this activates brain chemistry that really drives overeating. So being vigilant about getting rid of high fructose corn syrup, trans fats, MSG in your diet, those three things can make a huge difference, you know. And if you're vigilant about that, you'll make a huge progress in your health. The MSG, by the way, has about 50 different names, so you want to make sure you Google it and learn all the names, like hydrolyzed vegetable protein, which sounds good, but is actually MSG. Second is you want to get rid of the inflammatory foods like gluten and dairy, and then you want to add in foods that are anti-inflammatory. For example, most vegetables and fruits are anti-inflammatory. They're full of antioxidants and phytonutrients that are anti-inflammatory. Some of the most powerful anti-inflammatory foods are things like curcumin, spices like ginger, curcumin, garlic, very powerful anti-inflammatories. Omega-3 fats are very powerful anti-inflammatories. So any kind of fat that's a original fat that's from wild foods, which we don't eat much anymore except for fish, is very, very anti-inflammatory, so we include a lot of omega-3 fats in the diet. And by including omega-3 fats and spices and plant foods and anti-inflammatory foods, we can help the body cool off inflammation very quickly. And inflammation, from any cause, will cause weight gain and insulin resistance and prediabetes. So, you know, by cutting out the sugar and the inflammatory foods and eating more anti-inflammatory foods, which is what the 10-day detox diet does, you actually end up having a much more rapid and dramatic change in health. We had 600 people do this program, and in 10 days, they not only lost 4,000 pounds, and they dropped their blood sugar 20 points, and their blood pressure 10 points, but when we tracked all symptoms from all diseases, it went down by 62% in 10 days. There's no drug on the planet that could do that. It's the most powerful drug we have.
And Dr. Hyman, when people do the 10 days where they're removing dairy and alcohol and grains and beans and focusing on the foods that you mentioned and losing potentially quite a bit of weight in a short period of time, one of the food myths that you talk about is that rapid weight loss is bad and will lead to a rebound effect, and also that if you make small changes, you will lose weight. So here we have a program where there's going to be big changes for a short period of time and rapid weight loss. But you actually push back against these myths and say that the rapid weight loss itself isn't a concern. Can you talk a little bit about it?
Absolutely. You know, there was a wonderful review article on myths around obesity and weight loss in the New England Journal of Medicine that reviewed all the studies. And these points actually came from there. They're things that I've been using in my practice for years, but they were validated by looking at this research. And we find that people who actually make greater changes and more dramatic changes actually create more sustainable weight loss and get healthier because they actually see the benefits and they're more likely to be motivated. Again, with rapid weight loss, when you do any kind of program where you're quickly cutting out the foods that are causing weight gain and causing inflammation, you will see a lot of weight loss. Some people may lose 10 pounds in a day if they're very, very overweight and have a tremendous amount of fluid retention because they drop a lot of fluid and the inflammation is causing fluid retention. It's not actually fat, but they're losing fluid. So we see tremendous weight loss for people, 16 pounds, 10 pounds, 25 pounds for women in 10 days. And it's really designed to help people kickstart their metabolism. And when they do these changes, they tend to keep going with them, and they keep actually creating more sustainable results and get better over the long term.
So obviously, if people are doing the 10-day detox diet at home and they're not part of the study that you conducted, what is the best way for them to measure the before and after? Is it going to be simply weight, or should they be getting blood tests beforehand, or how does that work?
I think it varies. My dream is for everybody to actually be their own CEO of their own health, which requires them to be responsible for paying attention to what's going on in their body. So we track all their numbers. In fact, one of the things we find is that people that track their numbers and track their results do twice as well, lose twice as much weight, and have twice as success as people who don't. So writing down your weight every day, writing down your food intake, writing down your blood pressure and your blood sugar, which you can do through home testing devices like a blood pressure cuff and a blood testing kit you can get at the pharmacy, you actually begin to see your results, your waist size, your hip size. And then we actually have people track their symptoms. We have a special medical questionnaire called the toxicity quiz, and people can identify the symptoms they have through a 0 to 4 score. They get a score at the end of it. So do you have sinus problems, digestive issues, migraines, joint pain, fatigue, congestion, etc., depression, brain fog, and you read all these symptoms, and then after 10 days you retake the quiz and you can see the results. And this is where people get very inspired and motivated because they don't realize how quickly they can feel better. And then there are some blood tests I do recommend, the basic glucose tolerance test for people who think they have a risk for diabetes, which I outline how to find out in the book in a quiz, and also looking at the right type of cholesterol testing. And these can tell you a lot about what's happening with your body. And there may be other tests that are necessary, like checking for gluten sensitivity, food sensitivities, or other factors, thyroid issues, etc.
And then also people could retest their response to foods after they've avoided them for a while as well, I would imagine.
Absolutely. Then they reintroduce the food and you can see how you feel. But often it takes, between 6 to 12 weeks to heal what we call leaky gut, which is driving a lot of the inflammation for people. So when you get off the food, your body can then tolerate it over time.
So you do have a section on supplements. I know people often want to jump there and skip over all of the dietary changes, but supplements are a part of the 10-day detox diet. Tell us what some of the more useful ones are.
Well, supplements are just that, right? They're a supplement. They're not a replacement. So we want to be very careful to help people understand that, 80 or 90% of it is lifestyle, and a small percent is supplements. So diet is at least 70%, exercise maybe 10 to 20%, supplements maybe 10%, and again, the lifestyle practices around stress are in there as well. So I think the best supplements are really quite simple. Everybody needs a multivitamin, everybody needs fish oil, everybody needs vitamin D. After that, we begin to sort of customize, and then we explain how to customize in the book, depending on what your needs are. If you have a fatty liver, if you have hormonal issues, if you're diabetic, there may be additional things you want to take. But one of the key factors we use is a supplement called PGX, in addition to those that I mentioned. It's a fiber product that helps to reduce the absorption of sugar in the gut and actually improves blood sugar control, prevents the insulin spikes, and helps with cravings and weight loss and lowering blood sugar and cholesterol. So it's a very powerful product that can be used as a way to help really dramatically change the physiology very quickly.
And then you have, in terms of other products that you'd suggest, they would be tailored based on, as you said, the different conditions. So like if someone had diabetes, you might recommend cinnamon, for instance.
Absolutely. Functional medicine is science of personalization. It's personalized medicine, personalized lifestyle medicine. So we use that approach to be careful to customize this to every person's individual needs. But there are if people do the basic program, the 10-day detox diet, they will basically hit the reset and they can see what other things need to be done after that.
And then what are your thoughts on exercise and its role in the detox? I know that one of the myths you say is exercise is key to weight loss, but then again, you recommend it every day. So tell us about that strange role that exercise plays or doesn't play.
Exercise is critical for health. I would say that for sure. But it's a strategy for weight loss. It's terrible because if you, for example, have one soda, you have to walk 4.5 miles to burn it off. If you have one supersized meal, you have to run 4 miles every day for 1 week to burn off that one meal. If you have that every day, you have to run a marathon every day. There's no way you can exercise your way out of a bad diet, right? So people think that they can just exercise and lose weight, and often they won't or they'll lose a little bit, even though they'll be healthier, because they're not changing their diet. So diet is first, for sure, and then exercise as a part of a healthy lifestyle, absolutely, but not necessarily the strategy that we've been using, which is let's move, let's exercise more. That's the problem. It's not about that at all.
And also, the more you exercise, the hungrier you get as well.
That's right.
So it's a complicated scenario. But I do think the studies show that people who exercise while changing their diet have a more sustained long-term weight loss.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it helps to improve insulin sensitivity. It helps to reduce hunger and cravings that are happen as a result of insulin resistance. It helps to balance your blood sugar, lower blood pressure, thin your blood, reduce inflammation, improve detoxification, help you sleep better, help improve hormonal balance. All those things are true. And I think those are all essential for us to be healthy for the long term. But if people think they're going to exercise and not change their diet, and they have a big sports drink after they work out, unless you're Kobe Bryant running around the floor for 48 minutes in a basketball game, you don't want to be drinking Gatorade.
Right.
You've got 14 teaspoons of sugar in a bottle of Gatorade, which you think is a health drink.
So you finish the 10-day detox diet suggesting that people become a voice for social reform. What do you mean by that, and how can people get engaged on a socio-political level around these issues?
Well, it's really clear to me that this is a bigger problem than just us. So there's a chapter called "It's Bigger Than Us," and it's actually the section at the end of the book that sort of talks about the need for a grassroots movement for each of us to really be the advocates for health in the places where we live, right? So we can't make changes necessarily always on policy or with large corporations as an individual, but if we work together, it changes everything. So when you look at large movements that have changed everything in this country, whether it's abolition or civil rights or women's rights or gay rights, all these things started as grassroots movements. They didn't begin in Congress or start with policy. They ended in Congress. And in the same way, it's going to require a large-scale social reform to help us do this. That's going to be driven by people getting mad and doing the right thing and realizing that they have the power to change their own life and their own family's life and actually make those changes that make a difference. The biggest thing that people can do every day is eat to change not only their own health, but change the health of the environment and affect climate change, to change the health of our economy, because much of our economic woes are driven by obesity and chronic disease. And it changed even the fabric of our social structure that's breaking down is by reestablishing communities, reestablishing family dinner, reestablishing cooking, reestablishing, community-based events around getting healthy together, like we did, for example, at the Daniel Plan, where we had a church in Southern California do this approach, and they lost 250,000 pounds. 15,000 of them lost 250,000 pounds in a year. So there's a lot of things we can do, from social action to redesigning your own world to voting with your wallet to getting people just eating at home to getting involved in your community. All these things are really simple things we can do to help. And the movie Fed Up is really about activating that change and motivating people and giving them tools and toolkits to do this.
And do you feel optimistic about the political trends right now with regards to food and agriculture?
I see there are social trends. For sure, there's the food movement, and led by people like Michael Pollan and others, that are bringing these conversations to the forefront. Mark Bittman, and they're actually in that movie. But I think that on the political level, it's slow, and there's a lot of opposing forces. I think Michelle Obama's recent efforts to change food labeling, to change food marketing in schools, to create more transparency and hold accountable food industry, I think is a good thing. I think that we need to go further, absolutely.
And do you have a website you could point our listeners to if they want to learn more about you or your book?
Absolutely. So the 10-Day Detox Diet is about the 10-Day Detox Diet. Actually, it's called 10daydetox.com is the website. And drhyman.com is my main website. And people can sign up for my newsletter, follow me on Facebook and Twitter, and keep up with my philosophy and approach and get support for changing. And it includes a lot of support tools, our online community where people can do this together. And people who do this together lose twice as much weight as people who do it alone. And we really know that people do much better together.
Well, it was a pleasure having you back on Health Watch, Dr. Hyman.
Thank you so much for having me.
We are talking today to Dr. Mark Hyman about his new book, The 10-Day Detox Diet. If you missed part of today's program, you can go to kboo.fm/healthwatch, or you can go to iTunes and type Health Watch into the podcast store, one word, Health Watch, and pull up this and other shows. Stay tuned for the rest of the Monday morning radio zine.
You are tuned to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, your community radio station. Up next is Health and Healthcare Forum with host Roberta Hall. She'll be speaking with Jeff Schminsky, who developed a nonprofit toxic awareness body of Oregon to educate people about the dangerous health effects of many chemicals in everyday use, and to publicly advocate for stricter guidelines on applying pesticides and herbicides.
Welcome to the Health and Healthcare Forum. I'm Roberta Hall. Our series on health and healthcare features conversations about diverse health concerns. I enjoy these conversations, and I hope you do too. My guest today is Jeff Schminsky. He's very interested in toxicity and works a great deal on it, so that's what our topic will be today. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you very much for having me today.
Let's talk about your background and how you got interested, because you're very interested. You're president of a nonprofit.
That's correct.
That works on this topic.
Yes. Toxic Awareness Body of Oregon. I think my first venture into toxic effects on individuals was back in my college days. I went to college for applied psychology. and I had a chance to do some counseling with some Desert Storm veterans returning. There was quite a bit of toxic warfare over there that I didn't know what was happening, but a lot of these gentlemen that I would speak to that had some issues once they returned home, a lot of, you know, post-traumatic stress and so forth, a lot of it had to do with being exposed to different toxins. And so I studied a little bit more about some of the neurophysiological changes when you're exposed to certain toxins. That was kind of the beginning of it, and it led into some personal experiences. I had some floors refinished many years ago, and I went to stay in there, and I was very affected by the floor finish. And this was the early 2000s, late 1990s. And then it wasn't until later, until I moved to Oregon in 2005, that I had a chance to work at Your Green Home, which sold environmentally sensitive home and building supplies. And there I really learned a lot about all the different toxins that are in paint and finishes and mattresses, just about everywhere. Along with people that had acute sensitivities to specific chemicals, propylene glycol. I still remember one gentleman that wore a mask everywhere. He was very allergic to any type of plasticizers. Some people that had spent a lot of money on their home to make it very neutral so there were no toxins in their house. So that exposure and those stories from those people really kept me thinking about what we're exposed to in our society. Unfortunately, our business, Your Green Home, didn't make it, so I was able to work at a vineyard, which was actually a lifelong dream of mine, to work at a vineyard and make wine. And working out in the vineyard, some days, on nice spring days, we'd start to smell some different chemicals. And we don't use chemicals, we're a salmon-safe designated farm. And so there'd be airplanes spraying, and we could smell them, and occasionally we'd see some damage on the grapes. And that really led me into the chemical drift and the chemical drift trespass, which is a little bit different than the green building world.
It is, but there are overlaps. And let's mention that winery. It's Tai Winery, and they've been organic for a very, very long time.
That's right. They're one of the first vineyards in Oregon, 1974 plantings of some of their Pinot Noir and Chardonnays. Again, the Salmon Safe designation. The owners, Dave and Margie Buchanan, are tremendous stewards of the land, and Dave was actually a toxicologist. He studied crab in the 1970s, so he understands the effect of chemicals on aquatic life. There's Muddy Creek and Beaver Creek that border the property of the vineyard. So we want to be very careful about what we use on the farm, knowing that we're so close to riparian zones that that can really go into the waterways, which feed in the Marys and feed in the Willamette. And we have endangered Chinook in the Willamette. And so that's part of the reason for the Salmon Safe designation and that soft farming style there at Tai Cellars.
It's just a bit southeast of Corvallis. As you mentioned, the creeks go into the Marys eventually and the Willamette. Pretty big stuff.
It is, definitely. Not to mention the floodplains. They call it Lake Buchanan down there. So if you think about all the chemicals that are moving, if you spray them and you hit floodplains and they go across all that land and eventually subside and go back into the rivers. So you're really thinking of disbursement in a large area. It's not just concentrated to those creeks. So that's something that we keep in mind when we're out there working.
We have a few fairly large organic farms out that way.
Absolutely.
You learned something about toxicity in college, but then the experience in working with veterans who are still plagued, and that was an earlier war in the Middle East, but the follow-up ones, I suspect, are even more affecting in terms of the chemicals that people are exposed to.
I think the chemical warfare is something that isn't talked about a lot. We don't quite understand what our exposures are going to be and how they're going to affect individuals. And from what I understand, the Iraq War, there was quite a bit of chemical warfare used in that as well. And it's been going on for a long time, going back to the Agent Orange and the exposure that our veterans had there in Vietnam, not to mention the people that were native to that area and their exposure to the chemicals. So chemicals and war have gone hand in hand for a very long time. I think about that quite a bit in a way that we're almost having a warfare on our environment with the way that we use our sprays and the way that we devastate a lot of our aquatic life and our birds and our bees.
You met various people while you were working for Your Green Home and then decided public education was important, right?
At Your Green Home, we did a lot of outreach, a lot of raising awareness. What does it mean to be green? What kind of chemicals can you use? At what kind of levels can you use? And when we went out of business, I really felt like I wanted to continue spreading that message. And that was really a big impetus for me starting the nonprofit in 2008. And the name Toxic Awareness Body of Oregon, the acronym is TABOO. And I don't use that much, but I felt like chemical conversations was really a taboo in our society. We're surrounded by chemicals. People use chemicals. We've seen the devastation and the harm from overuse of chemicals and even just any use of chemicals. And so it really began as a way for me to have a conversation opener with people. They ask you, well, what do you do now? Well, I run this nonprofit. It's about chemicals. It's about chemical drift. It's about our chemical exposure. So that was kind of the name and the reason for the name. Unfortunately, I can't use that acronym due to it being claimed by another business, but I still felt like it was taboo and I wanted to bring it out into the public and get people talking about it. And that's a lot of what I do, is literally just going neighbors to neighbor, asking about, you know, what kind of chemicals do they use, or if I see someone spraying, just stopping and talking to them about what they're using, what do they know about it, how much are they using, is it the right day, is it too hot, is it too windy. A lot of different studies that I like to research, you know, on fish and wildlife, on birds and bees. So there's a lot of different areas that that conversation can lead into. And people start to think a little bit like, well, yeah, I do use that chemical, but I never really thought about it that way or having an effect on that way. Or I've used that chemical and I have gotten headaches and I have gotten dizziness and I just thought it was, you know, part of the process. That's really a lot of the reason why I began that nonprofit, is just so it could be a conversation piece. And it has grown into that as the need for more awareness and monitoring especially has come to the forefront.
You have a Facebook page.
I don't have a Facebook page. No, I definitely need some help on the technological side of things. Kind of the old-fashioned conversation, people-to-people, talking with people. But I would love to have someone help me build a website or build a website for me. Social media is fantastic. Need some volunteers. Need some help there.
You are very concerned, I think many people are, about plastics of all sorts because, of course, they don't degrade well.
Plasticizers, and those are very difficult for water treatment plants to filter out. Those plasticizers are unique. They bond differently. They bond with other type of organic chemicals that are existing around us. And they also have